Yeah, it's a good question. Mr. Brewer has many expressions for different ways of going beyond the absolute halacha, bal nefesh, yirei shemayim, all of these different things. And people want to know, so does that mean that I should do it, or am I not on that madrega, right? That's how does a person know? You know, it is a hard question. Part of it is, you know, you can almost say, you know, if you're not sure, you know, you're not it, you know, it's just kind of... but the other thing is you have to ask yourself, basically, to be honest with yourself, how conscientious am I in all of the obligations that I'm absolutely mechuyev to you? In other words, you really cannot consider yourself, and again, I'm not putting anyone down, but none of us can consider ourselves on that madrega unless we're zohir in all of the halachas that we're mechuyev to be zohir in, and that includes bein adam mamakom, and that also includes bein adam lechaveiro. That's one test I would look at. Another test I would look at is that if taking on an extra practice of a bal nefesh makes me anxious and tense, then spiritually it is not the right step for me to take. Because for Kert, if as a result of being machmer in one inyan, I kind of lose my temper in something in other areas, in which is mamash a daraisa of anger and everything else, then it's more important to concentrate on your chiyuvim. So I would say, b'kitzer, the two things you look at is how careful are you in everything you have to keep, and the second is this step going to make me nervous and tense, or is this kind of the natural outgrowth? In Ruchnius, there is a natural progression of things. In other words, just as you know, you grow from a child to a teenager to an adult, etc. So Ruchni is also that way. And when you're not yet on the madrega for something, it actually is counterproductive to go for it. So I don't know. That's kind of very general, but in some ways, you know, I would look at it that way. Yeah.
What are the halachic issues regarding gambling and making a living, doing it on the side? Adas.
Yeah, so there is a category that Chazal talk about, Masachik Bakufia. That's people who play with dice, or Mafricha Yonim, people who bet on bird races. It used to be a popular activity. And Chazal indicate many Mishnayos that Mafricha Yonim and Masachik Bakufia are posuliatis. They're not eligible to give testimony in a Jewish court. They are posuliatis. Now, there are two different reasons the Gemara gives why this type of gambling activity might make a person puzzle. One is based on a principle called asmachta. Asmachta are bets. There is a concept that when I collect on a bet, I'm a bit of a goslin because the guy that's betting didn't expect to lose. And therefore, he never really had kavana to pay me if he lost. So according to that svara, a gambler who collects money for his gambling, even if it's sporadic, would be treated as a goslin because the person who is paying the money didn't really intend to part with it. There is another view of the Gemara, however, that says the problem with gambling is not esmachta, now what you're collecting is what you're collecting, but it's because the person is not engaged in a productive activity. The person is simply gambling. He's not producing anything. He's not selling anything, etc. By the way, that has some very interesting repercussions on a lot of things in the stock market, but I'll come to that in a moment. Now, there is a practical nafkamina between these two answers, and that is, if the psul of a professional gambler is a smachta, then even a one-time gamble would be gezeila. You're a goslin. Once you're a goslin, you're not kachuliatis. If, on the other hand, the problem is that you're not engaged in something productive, and therefore you're considered to be a useless person, so to speak, so that only applies to a person whose whole parnasa is from gambling, and that would not apply to a person who is useful in some particular way. So there is a machlokas hadapaskin. The subject of esmachta is enormously complicated, because obviously there are many types of gambling activities that are halachically kosher. An example would be yeshivos have raffles all the time. And what's a raffle? I mean, basically I'm giving money in order to win something, but we don't say if I don't win, I want my money back, right? So raffles are bets, essentially. Lemaisa, we paskin therefore that the main psul of gambling is because you're not a productive person, and as a result, sporadic, temporary gambling, which is not part of your main parnasa, we do paskin that you're kosher, your kosher liatis. Now, the problem with that is that opens up a very big hole, because once you start saying people who are not productive in their lives are pasul liatis, well, what about somebody who doesn't work at all? I don't mean he sits in the sorry, that's very productive, but I mean he just lives off his parents' wealth, doesn't do anything. He doesn't gamble, but he watches television all day. Are we going to say that he's pasul liatis? Well, maybe so, maybe so. A yid has to have something in his life that is significant. Torah is the most significant, but at least if you're not learning, at least you're working, you're doing something. You're not simply living off wealth and the like. But also, this raises questions about people that have jobs, people who are in securities, day traders, right? I mean, what are the people who buy low and sell high, currency speculators? There's a whole huge field of people who make millions and millions and millions of dollars, in which they're not making anything, they're not adding to the economy, they're simply manipulating products and the like. So that's a very, very tricky question. When does certain types of securities trading become the same as habitual gambling? I don't want to get into the economics of it. I mean, one could analyze it. One says basically that the creation, well, okay. I mean, I'm not a big expert in the business aspects of this, but there is an argument that is made that the creation of wealth through the secondary transfers actually enhances the value of stock, and as a result, it enables companies to raise more money to make the products that they make. In other words, there is a theory that the manipulations of securities, assuming there's no dishonesty, that's a separate issue, I mean, assuming there's no dishonesty, even though all you're doing is betting on the market, that's not called wasteful activity, because betting on the market, in a sense, can strengthen the ability of corporations to sell stock, which in turn can enhance their manufacturing capacities, and therefore, within the definition of osek b'yishuvo shalolam, this is called osek b'yishuvo shalolam. So, by the way, this illustrates an important example that in order to analyze a halacha properly, you have to understand the factual background. One has to understand the stock market. One has to understand the economics of the capitalist system, because otherwise you wouldn't be able to know, is this a wasteful activity or is this a constructive activity? But the bottom line is that, if you ask me lahalacha, that we are choshesh l'chumra for the esmachta shita as well, and as a result it is not proper to even do sporadic gambling for money. But that's more of a chumra. The main reason is only the habitual gambler that is makes most of his parnasa from gambling. By the way, I want to mention that gambling can be a very serious addiction. I remember I spoke once in Las Vegas. There's a religious, not to the gamblers, I mean, I spoke, you know, it was a Chabad house, whatever it is. There's actually a religious community in Las Vegas. There are day schools and a kollel, all sorts of things. But the culture in Las Vegas is overwhelmingly one of gambling. You know, you go to the bathroom at the airport, there'll be slot machines, you know, next to the sinks, you know, in the airports and the like. And one of the rabbis there told me that he often gets calls from religious Jews who came from New York in the middle of the night, kind of saying things like, I don't know what to tell my wife. I just gave away our house. I thought I was, you know, doing well, and then I started losing things, so I put up my house in an attempt just to get things back. So, you know, people are going, you know, you can really, really go crazy in this. So one has to be very, very careful. Well, that's a very good question. Interesting question. In a sense, what comes out in a child is indicative of a certain amount of flaw within yourself. But we have to say that even if a person excels in a certain midah, and that becomes his dominant midah, if he is overwhelmingly a tzaddik, who is so close to Hashem, so in a sense, his yiras shamayim will compensate for what might be a little bit of a tiny flaw in character. Meaning to say that even if Avram would be Nimshech after Chesed when it would be inappropriate, he knew that Yiras Shemayim held him back. That's why he was able to do the Akedah, which is a contradiction to the Midah of Chesed. But the problem basically is that the next generation may not have that same strength and koach, so the dominant gene, so to speak, gets transferred to the next generation without the tremendous Yiras Shemayim that can act as a control. And that's why I think you'll find that the character flaw tends to be manifest in the next generation. And again, a mashal that is given by Svarim, it's a physical mashal, is if you have a bridge, let's imagine you're building a bridge, and when you start building the bridge, let's say you're building it from two different ends, right? They have to meet in the middle. So you can, if you start being off just by a tiny little bit, by a tenth of a millimeter, by the time you get to the middle, the two halves aren't going to meet. So sometimes something can be a tiny flaw in an av, but it gets greatly magnified in succeeding generations. Right? So that's why for the Avos HaKadoshim, whatever flaw we see was tiny and basically almost invisible, but it later got manifested into a much bigger crack.
Yeah. Why is it that we almost seem to have a disdain for Leah? Like, she's not counted amongst the Imoris who, Hashem craved her fears because she wasn't barren. And it's a big thing made about Rochel, but I mean, Leah was the progenitor of most of Klal Yisrael. Why is it almost like a less of a focus on her?
Well, first of all, I understand what you're saying. Of course, Leah has six of the 12 Shvatim. Leah has Shevet Yehuda. Leah has David HaMelech. Leah has Mashiach. Leah has Kohanim and Levim. Right? So I wouldn't really say she's excluded from things. In many, many ways, she does represent the epitome of the person whom Hashem has blessed with good fortune. And of course, she's buried next to Yaakov, which Rachel is not. On the other hand, it is also very, very true that Leah is the paradigm of the rejected wife. It's kind of a tragic, sad story that she is the one that, through no fault of her own, basically, her father substituted her to cheat Yaakov, and her sister gave her the way to stay with Yaakov, right, which otherwise would have been discovered. And the Torah uses a lashon that is unbelievable. Now, none of us ever assume that that's literal, but on the other hand, this is what the Torah says. The Torah does not say he loved Rachel more than Leah, although it does say that in one place. But the Torah's lashon is much stronger. The Torah's lashon is he hated Leah. Now, again, Chazal don't understand, chas v'shalom, that he hated Leah. They just say, as compared to his love for Rachel, it was like hate to love. But still, it's a very strong language. And note the way that Leah names her children. She has a first child, Reuben. She says, Hashem has seen my suffering, and now my husband will love me. Shimon, Hashem has heard my cry, and now my husband is. It all goes back to wanting Yaakov. Levi, now my husband will be with me. Yehuda, I'm grateful for what I got. It actually is a sense of descent, meaning there was hope. Like three times as a chazakah, there was hope with the first three children that the relationship would have been better. Apparently it was not. Yehuda already says, I'll be grateful for what I have and not seek more. So there is a certain pathos, a certain tragedy here. In fact, there is a medrash that says the following idea, that because Leah was rejected, God gave her the reward of all of these shvatim, including Malchus and Kahuna and Leviah, because Shlomo HaMelech says, Elokim Yivakesh Es HaNirdaf. What does that pasuk mean? HaKadosh Baruch Hu protects the victim. Hashem looks after the victim. Leah is treated as a victim. And as a victim, HaKadosh Baruch Hu gave her many, many brachas. So I would not say at all that we should look at Leah as with disdain. I mean, she is the aim of Malchus and the aim of Kahuna and Leviah, Moshe Rabbeinu is from Maya, David HaMelech, Mashiach, Aaron, the Kohen Gadol, all the Kohanim. We have to look at it, that if somebody is disdained and somebody is rejected, as on some level she was, HaKadosh Baruch Hu gives them extra brachos. That's how we should look at that Leah, certainly. Yeah.
What are the main hyscopic differences between Osmeh and H?
You know, these are interesting discussions, and I'll talk about it a little bit. You know, the history is very interesting. First, a little history that maybe you should know, just institutional history. This is way before my time, but I'm aware of it. And that is, there were four people who started Or Sameach. There was Rav Mendel Weinbach Zatzal, Rav Noach Weinberg Zatzal, Rav Yaakov Rosenberg, Zichrono Livracha, and Rav Nata Schiller, who's Baruch Hashem Rosh Yeshiva, that is still with us. Four people started an institution. It was the first institution designed to bring Torah to those who didn't have a background. There were Balei Tshuva before, so Or Sameach did not invent Balei Tshuva. Avraham Avinu did some Kirov work as well. But Or Sameach was really the first main yeshiva to work with beginners. Its initial name was not Or Sameach, it was Shema Yisrael. But the Israeli government would not allow an institution to go with the name Shema Yisrael. They said that was not copyrightable. You can't copyright Shema Yisrael. That's too famous an expression. So it became Or Sameach, named after Rav Meir Simcha, whose picture you should definitely look at if you haven't seen him, the great Or Sameach, great Gadol and Tzaddik. Now, what's interesting is that Rav Noach Weinberg broke off everything, right? In a way, what can I say? Just like, I shouldn't say it this way. Just like Christianity and Islam are breakaways from Judaism, you know? Eish HaTorah is a breakaway. Eish HaTorah is a breakaway from Or Sameach. And Rav Yaakov Rosenberg, Zatzal, I don't know if you knew him, started Machon Shlomo. So Machon Shlomo and Eish HaTorah both come from Or Sameach. We are kind of the mother of all of those yeshivos. As well, well, that to say, Chappelle's is the center is kind of a breakaway from Chappelle, so in a way, there's kind of an even thing here. But now, the difference in Hashgav is the following: first of all, there's much more in common, right? Torah min haShemayim, Emuna, Limud haTorah, Mitzvahs, right? We're all in the same team here. We're not competing in that way, and that's the most important thing to keep in mind. The difference between Or Sameach and Eish HaTorah, this is a caricature, meaning there's a mixture of both, is that Eish HaTorah, I'll give you two differences. Eish HaTorah, number one, believes in spending much more time on what you might call systematic theology, meaning before we learn Gemara, you got to know that the Torah is from Hashem, and you got to know the 49 paths of wisdom, and you have to know the 8 proofs for the existence of God, and you have to know all of the proofs for a revelation of Sinai, and only then we can learn Gemara. Or Sameach does have an opposite hashgacha. Or Sameach believes that the light of the Torah, the Torah itself, will bring you to an understanding. That instead of explaining to you for a year why Gemara is important, you know, you learn it. And if you learn it, you become changed. So in some ways, one school emphasizes going more over the theology and the philosophy, and the other says, let's get right into the learning. But, as you know, that's a little bit of a caricature. You know, we have in the Shorish program, and many of you might go to that too, Rabbi Gottlieb, other people who do devote time and effort to the philosophical issues. But as I say, in Eish, I think they're a bit more involved in that. It takes much longer, and it's much more intensive. It's probably more organized as well. They have more people doing it, and the like. So Or Sameach emphasizes, do the learning, and you'll become changed. Eish HaTorah says, no, we have to change you before you're ready to do the learning. That's kind of the one difference. Difference number two is that Eish has something very much in common with Chabad, in that sense. And that is, Eish HaTorah believes that every single person's responsibility is to go out and do outreach. So as soon as you know how to learn a Mishnah, we got to use you already to go out and be Makarev people in different ways. And therefore, there's a tremendous emphasis in getting people into Jewish outreach as soon as possible. Or Sameach, Hashkafa, although obviously we're committed to Kirev, is that a person's primary responsibility is to develop himself and to become as big a Yirei Shamayim and a Talmud Chacham as he's able to become. And then the concept is you will influence others by filling up a Kiddush cup, you've heard that, Marshall, by the wine that you're taking in, overflowing and influencing others. So thus you'll find that Eishe Torah does not really subscribe to the idea of people learning for many, many years. Or Sameach, you know, we know people are all different, but Or Sameach does try to encourage people to learn in yeshivas as long as they can. And so that I would say are the two basic differences. Now, the other difference is Eish has a lot more money. And, you know, that makes a difference. Their building is just phenomenally beautiful. We live in humble ways, but as I say, Pirkei Avos says, the Derech of Torah is bread and water and sleep on the floor. So in many ways, Baruch Hashem, keep you closer in spirit to Pirkei Avos. But having said that, you know, we need, the Ribbono Shel Olam has given many, many Derechim in which Torah needs to be spread. Different people need different things, different approaches, speak to people in different ways. So Baruch Hashem, you know, Eish does a wonderful work, and you know, we hope Or Sameach does wonderful work, and both of them are needed by the Ribbono Shel Olam to spread his Torah and bring people to back to Yiddishkeit. Yeah.
Prior to the rise of the Yeshiva world, even going back 100 years, we showed them on it, how many Jews, what proportion of Jews were learning Torah?
Well, okay, you can even ask the same question after the Yeshiva world. Now keep in mind that it is true that we sometimes exaggerate a little bit the level of Torah learning in Europe. You know, we talk about Europe. We think that every shoemaker, you know, knew Shas and Shulchan Aruch. You know, in Europe there were certainly Amoratsim, etc. But the truth of the matter is, the average Jew in Europe did not go to yeshiva. Yeshivas were very elite institutions. They were for Eloyim, brilliant people, sometimes rich people, you know, could afford it. The average Yid in Europe went to Cheder until around 13 or 14, and then they would be apprenticed to a shoemaker, a tailor, a storekeeper, and they would work. Right? So the average, you know, the average Jew, the average Jew in the street, you know, he was a working person who worked very hard for very little money, and spent his whole day in Parnassa. But what is interesting is, it is true, and this is not exaggeration, that even the average poor working person set aside time every day to learn Torah. Now, it wasn't necessarily Gemara. Some of them could not understand Gemara. But there were shiurim and chaye yadam. You know, chayyadam is like, it's like a Kitzur Shulchan Aruch, but it was, Kitzur Shulchan Aruch was written in Hungary. Chayyadam is literature. He's the Vilna Gaon's brother-in-law. Chayyadam ein Yaakov, Agadata. You know, some learned Mishnayos, some said Tehillim. So if you ask me what percentage of people learned Torah on a regular basis, it was close to 100%. Now, how many hours? Okay, maybe it was a half an hour a day, maybe it was an hour a day. On Shabbos, people would often, in Lita, the minhag was that the average working person stayed up all night Friday night to learn. They would come to the shul after the Suda. Mishmar was not Thursday night, Mishmar was Friday night. They would actually learn Friday night. So it really is not an exaggeration to talk about the fact that even the working class Jew, who may not have been a Talmud Chacham, was very, very connected to the idea of daily Torah learning. Now, the yeshiva world didn't change that so much. You know, the whole yeshiva world, the world of the great yeshivas, only dates from Rav Chaim Volozhiner, and that's around, I think Volozhiner was like 1809, or something like that. But if you took together the total percentage of the Jewish population that were learning in yeshivas, maybe it was between 10 and 15%. You actually have more... You certainly have more people learning in Kolim and yeshivas now than you ever had in Europe. So the yeshiva world created a more, more intense learning, a more in-depth learning. It produced great Talmidei Chachamim, but the average Hamonam was not in yeshiva. The average boy did not go to yeshiva after Cheder, but still there was this concept of daily learning. It was a very, very strong idea. Okay?
How about, like I said, even further back, was...
Well, you know, when we say that Rav Chaim Volozhiner invented the first yeshiva, you know, that's really not true. First of all, there were yeshivas in the time of the Tanoim and the Amoraim. Sura was Rav's yeshiva. Pumpedisa was Abaya's yeshiva. Naharda was Shmuel's yeshiva. You know, these were great yeshivas. And all the Rishonim, and the Ramban had a yeshiva. The Ramban actually didn't have. The Rambam didn't have a yeshiva per se. The Rambam wrote, and the Rambam was the Rav of Cairo. The Rambam gave shiurim and the like. But there was no yeshiva. But the Ritva had a yeshiva. The Ran had a yeshiva. So there were yeshivas. But I think we say the following. We say that Rav Chaim Volozhiner was unique because by the time the 19th century rolled around, you had international yeshivas where people came from many, many countries. In the Middle Ages, you just didn't have the transportation, so you tended not to attract Talmidim from all over the world. So the Ramban's yeshiva was in Spain. His Talmidim were Spanish, you know, etc. So in that sense, there were many, many yeshivas, even before Rav Chaim Volozhiner, but they tended to be local institutions, which may have like one Rosh Yeshiva would sometimes give a share, etc. But most of the learning were that, you know, Talmidim and Chavrutas by themselves without a central focus. Okay, but yeshivas were always existed. So, yeah.
Okay, so what is the halacha regarding the apocrypha and pseudo apocrypha? Are we allowed to read it? Not in terms of learning it, obviously, but for example, from an historical perspective, are we allowed to read Maccabees or?
Yeah. So apocrypha, which is Greek for hidden books, is what Chazal call Svarim Chitzonim, the outside books, the external books. And this refers to various Svarim that were written during the Bayis Sheni, and there was some initial question whether they should be included in Tanakh as being divinely inspired, or should they not be. And Chazal made a judgment that these Svarim were neither Nevuah nor Ruach HaKodesh, and Chazal excluded them from the canon of Kisvei HaKodesh. They are called the Apocrypha. They are excluded books. Now, the mere fact that something is excluded doesn't automatically mean negative. It just means it doesn't have the Kedusha of Tanakh. Well, are you allowed to read it? Are you allowed to learn it? By the way, Derech Agav, I just want to tell you, in the Catholic Bible, the Old Testament, so to speak, includes the Apocrypha. So if you get yourself a Catholic Bible, not that I'm recommending it, you will see that at the end of the Old Testament, they have all the apocryphal books. The Protestant Bibles are like, at least the Old Testament, are like ours. They don't include the Apocrypha. So it's interesting. Now, what books are in the Apocrypha? So one book, actually it's four books, but it's called the Book of the Maccabees. The historical story of Hanukkah is there, right? There are other books, Ben Sira, which is a book of wisdom, very similar to Mishle and the like. That's in the Apocrypha. So let me just say this. There are different reasons why Chazal excluded certain books, and that would determine whether they're appropriate to read or not appropriate to read. Some books of the Apocrypha were excluded because Chazal considered them to contain ideas of Apikorsis. They were written by different sects, like the Dead Sea Scroll, Essenes, and the like, and the Hashkafa that they express is not a Hashkafa that was the truth of Judaism, and therefore Chazal felt these were detrimental. Now, those books, indeed, it is not proper to read. They are called Sifrei Minos Ukfira. And like any other Sifrei Minos Ukfira, you're only allowed to read it if you need to know in order to answer objections and the like. But Stamazai not. Now, other books, however, were excluded, not because they have anything negative in them, but simply because they're not deemed to be holy. An example of that is the Book of the Maccabees and Ben Sira. So those books of the Apocrypha are totally mutter to read, but just recognize that they don't have any more authority than any other historical book. Now, in fact, the Rishonim do quote the Book of the Maccabees for various, Rashi quotes for various historical details, and Chazal quote Ben Sira to illustrate Musar and Chachma. Okay? So what I'm saying is, Svarim Chitzonim are not in one bag. Some svarim chitzonim are excluded because of kfira, and some are excluded not for a negative reason, but simply because they're not considered to be kaddish. So if you're asking me specifically, can you read the book of the Maccabees to determine the historical background of Hanukkah, the answer is you can. Of course, one very interesting thing about the book of the Maccabees, this raises some interesting questions, is that the book of the Maccabees does not mention the miracle of the Neros. It discusses the holiday of Hanukkah as a rededication of the Beis HaMikdash, commemorating the military victories over Yavan and overthrowing the Greek domination of Eretz Israel. It does not mention the Nes of the Neros. Now, that doesn't mean that it's making the statement it didn't happen. We believe it happened, but it's simply saying that the Iker Yom Tov was for the Chanukah HaMikdash. In other words, this answer is this is actually an answer to the Beis Yosef's famous question. The Beis Yosef asks a very, very, this is one of the most famous questions in Torah. That is, we say that we celebrate Hanukkah for 8 days because they found enough oil for one day, but the menorah burnt for 8 days. So frek to Beis Yosef, so Hanukkah ought to be 7 days because there's no miracle for the first day. This is a famous question of the Beis Yosef. There are at least 500 answers to this question. I know this because I saw a sefer that has 500 answers to this question. But the MS is, according to the book of the Maccabees, it actually is not a question. Because the book of the Maccabees says that and by the way, the Maharal was mechaving to this. The Maharal gives this as a teretz without using the book of the Maccabees. So you can root this in authentic Torah learning as well, that the 8 days of Hanukkah was not because of the miracle of the menorah. It was the 8-day celebration of the dedication of the Beis HaMikdash. And you find even in the Torah, when the Mishkan was dedicated, there was an 8-day ceremony. So according to that, the 8 days is not connected to the menorah necessarily. The 8 days is connected to the Chanukah Sabayis. So that's the type of thing that, you know, is permitted, and you can see interesting things. I think in some way, though, I'll tell you, the Book of the Maccabees, I think, may give you more information than you want, because it goes over every single battle in great, great detail. I mean, this is like 20 years of fighting. And it tells you the generals on both sides. So, you know, so if you're a military historian, you really understand exactly the battles. But for many people, it's kind of a bit more detailed than they really want to know.
Which are the Mutter books besides Ezra and Nachman? Which are the Usher books?
Yeah. Well, okay. There's something called the Sefer Hayovlos, which is Usher. And the like. I don't remember all the titles right now. One thing I'll tell you, the Apocrypha also has additions to Megillas Esther and additions to the Book of Daniel. They have additions to existing books. By the way, you know, Megillas Esther, everybody has the famous observation that the name of Hashem is not mentioned in Megillas Esther. So the Apocrypha, Hosafa, has the name of Hashem in it. So they tried to make it more firm, but Chazal saw it as a forgery. So, in other words, it's interesting. They saw the more religious version as not the authentic, not the original version, so to speak. I could tell you later. I have to look at the list to remember. But I can tell you that, number one, Ben Sira is fine. Book of Maccabees is fine. And the other raya, there's a book that is called the Chachma Shlomo. Now, it is stated to be written by Shlomo HaMelech, but again, it's apocryphal, so we don't believe it was. But I can tell you for sure that Chachma Shlomo is Mutter. I know this, absolutely. And the way I know this is because the Ramban in the Hakdama to his Perush al HaTorah quotes extensively from the Sefer Chachma Shlomo. So there you have an Eidus Gemura that is a Sefer that one is allowed to look at. Yeah.
What are the halakhas of prisoners, and how does that play into the prisoner exchanges that we see in the
Well, this is an enormously difficult issue. Israel has a policy which they never keep, but Israel says over and over, and our policy is we do not negotiate with terrorists, but we're going to make an exception. Now, the problem is every single time this happens, they make an exception. So as far as I know, I'm not aware, except for Entebbe, where they did a military raid, I'm not aware of any case where Israel said, we're not going to go negotiate with terrorists. So it's funny. People say no rule has an exception, but this is a rule that only has exceptions. There is no rule for the rule. Now, the most recent issue is already more than a year old, with Gilad Shalit's, in which he had been in captivity for a number of years, for more than 5 years, and Israel released, I think, over 1,000 terrorists in prison to secure his exchange. By the way, Israel has even released terrorists not only to get live people back, but even to get dead bodies of soldiers back. And people don't like to talk about this because obviously we don't want Gilad Shalit to feel that, well, we wished he would have stayed there and would have gotten killed. So, we're very happy, Baruch Hashem, that he's back and should be healthy and safe. But there's an enormous difficulty here, and that is, pigeon shvuyin is a matter of pikuach nefesh. There's no question. Getting somebody out of captivity is literally a matter of life and death. But the question is, are we permitted to save a life by doing something that is going to directly endanger the lives of maybe many more people in the future? Are we allowed to save life by endangering life? Are we allowed to save Gilad Shalit by releasing terrorists back into the population who, God forbid, might kill 10, 20, 30, or 100 people in the future? This is the big shaila. So there's a Mishnah in Gittin. Actually, it's in HaShaleach. I don't know if you'll get that far, but if you get towards the end of the perek, you'll actually have the answer to your sugya in terms of analyzing it. And the Mishnah says, Chazal made a takana, that when people were captured, captive, kidnapped, held for hostage by terrorists or criminals, we do not pay excessive ransom to those demands. And the reason that's given is because we do not want to encourage further hostage takings in the future. The terrorist needs to know that he's not going to get profit out of this, because otherwise he'll continue to go so in the future. So, yeah.
Just in regards to that, we saw when Ishmael was dying in the desert, and Hashem saved him, and the Malachim argued on him, and Hashem said, well, he did Tshuva now, so we have to look at it now.
Right.
Hashem knew he was going to be Russia. So
yeah.
In regards to us, who are we to say,
yeah,
the future, I mean, is it fuck the fish
right
now?
So very good. So here's the thing. Now, on one level, I'm going to get to your point. Your point is an excellent point. On one level, a Gilad Shalit deal is even worse than the Mishnah, because the Mishnah was simply describing paying money that will encourage future hostage taking. Here, we're doing more than paying money. We are releasing the actual murderers into the population who might murder again. So because of this, there were poskim who did take the position that we are not allowed to release terrorists, even if that means that, unfortunately, a Jewish captive is going to have to die, because we have to create a circumstance where we don't encourage hostage taking. The enemy has to know they will get nothing from hostage taking. On the other hand, the great posek who matured it was none other than Ruvaji Yosef, Zatzal. And his position was very close to what you said. And he said, well, listen, we have a klal in the Gemara, ein safek motzi midei vadai. That means to say, the certain overrides the uncertain and speculative. When you have a person who is directly and immediately in a state of sakana, you are mechuyev to do what you can to take the person out of sakana, even if there's a possibility that you might be endangering other people, because that is only a possibility. It is a speculation. It is a guess. It is a prediction. And, we could have better security. There might be other things that we could do and the like. So Rav Avadya basically said, the vadai sakana of the moment overrides the safek sakana of the future. So essentially we have, of course, the question you're going to ask is, well, how could Rav Avadya say that? Doesn't the Mishnah say the opposite? The Mishnah says, we don't pay the ransom. So Rav Avadya wants to learn, that's talking about a hostage whose life is not in danger. it's a very big dokuk. He's saying, yeah, he was kidnapped and he's being held for ransom, but they're not going to kill him. Masha ain kain, when it's pikuach nefesh, you got to save him. So essentially, all I can tell you is that a situation like the Gilad Shalit situation is a big, big machlokas aposkin. Rav Avadya said, the imperative of saving the definite person b'sakana overrides future dangers. Other poskim say that we're not allowed to save a person in a way that's going to create future sakana for other people. There's a third approach which comes out the same as Rav Avadya for a different reason, and they basically say that when you're dealing with an enemy who's trying to destroy you anyway, so whether you release terrorists or not, they're still going to terrorize. Meaning, it's not like in the Gemara's case, if they weren't going to get the money, they'll stop kidnapping. Unfortunately, in our situation, even if they get nothing out of it, they'll continue to do it. So, in a sense, the argument is you're not increasing the danger by giving into their demands. So, it is a big machlokas. If you get to the sugya of Ein Podenes HaShavuyin, Yaisir Mechdei Deneim, so you'll be able to think about this some more. Let me just mention, historically, there was one of the greatest of the Rishonim was Rav Meir Mirutenberg. Rothenburg was a city in Germany. Maharam Mirutenberg lived in the 1300s, and he was the Rebbe of the Rush. Rebbe of the Rush. And he actually was kidnapped by some German nobility, held for money, as was common. And he ordered his community not to ransom him, because he didn't want to encourage hostage taking. And he spent 7 years in a kind of as a prisoner, and he died, and even after he died, they didn't want to release the body till a ransom was paid, and I think the body was held for like 7 years. It was a miracle that the body did not decompose. Finally, somebody did pay the money to bury the body. Probably the Maharam wouldn't have wanted that, but they did it. But that's an example of a great Gadol actually applying that teaching to his own life.
I remember reading once that upon a confirmation that war is that the parents who are involved, like what the thought process or, you know, thinking about the Shekhinah and all these other sort of important things, have a big impact on the child's future.
Yeah.
If that's so, how is there such a stark difference between Yaakov and Esau, considering that the confirmation was done at the same time?
Yeah, you know, it's a very interesting thing. In some Kabbalistic sources, it actually says that, you know, Rivka was very concerned because when she walked by a place of Avodah Zorah, Esav wanted to come out. When she walked by a place of Kedusha, Yaakov wanted to come out. She couldn't understand this fighting. Her life became unbearable. There is at least one Kabbalistic source that actually says that Yaakov and Esav were originally not twins. It was one person who had a tremendous koach of tov, counterbalanced with a tremendous koach of ra. And Rivka prayed she couldn't bear that the tov would be balanced with such a strong yetzer hara. So as a result, they were split into two halves, where the ra went to Esav and the tov went to Yaakov. But the question still becomes, all right, be it as it may, but if Yaakov and Rivka were in such a high madrega, how is it possible for that to be there? Well, again, it is very true that the machshava of a husband and a wife at the time of intercourse and conception brings down the holiness of the neshama. But in a sense, you have to know that that's true only after the cosmic purification forces took place, meaning the following. In Avraham, there was a certain psilus, a certain negativity that came out in Yishmael. In Yaakov, there still was something that, I'm sorry, in Yitzchak rather, there was still something that came out in Esav. So the Avos, you're still dealing with refining, getting rid of the evil. Only with Yaakov are our neshamos now in a pure level of Kedusha. And therefore, the machshava can bring down higher Kedusha. In other words, what I'm saying is, until you've completed the refining process, anything could happen. It's only after Yaakov was born that in Yaakov, the refining process was complete, so the Jewish soul is pure and holy and untainted. So then, machshavos can determine the strength of the Kedusha and everything else.
Okay.
Yeah.
If that's so, then it was Asaph's free, like it says that Asaph was striving towards the void of Zorah before he's even born.
Yeah.
How does that work in, you know, his free will? And like, it's, you say Yaakov was a sudden, if he was born, Yaakov was going to.
You know, Rav Shadran, who was a great Maggid of Yerushalayim, Rav Shalom Shadran, used to say that if Esav would walk into a Beis Medrash, we would think we were looking at the Gadol Hador. We would think we were looking at the holiest man who ever lived. You know, we have this caricature of Esav, but primarily only because vis-a-vis Yaakov, Esav was on a much lower madrega. But he said, in point of fact, Esav's righteousness, it's hard to reconcile that with a lot of what Chazal say, it's true, unless you understand it non-literally. But Rosh Hashanah says Esav's righteousness was beyond our comprehension. And whatever is described as his sinfulness is only according to his madrega. It is greatly sin, but vis-a-vis us, it would be righteous. Now, that's one thing to keep in mind, that Esav was not kind of just a real, you know, decadent Russia. He was a son of Yitzchak and had a great madrega. But this issue of Bechira, when people are born with bad natures. So we have to assume like this, like the Gemara says, if you're born under the red planet, you'll be a shedder of blood, but you can choose to use your talents in a good way. Yes, Hashem gives everybody different nisyonos, and undoubtedly it was the case that Esav had a certain struggle that Yaakov didn't have. Yaakov had struggles Esav didn't have. And Esav may have had an atiyah towards violence and the like. But at the same time, HaKadosh Baruch Hu gave him the koach of Bechira. This is a similar story with, remember Chizkiyahu HaMelech, a very righteous king, didn't want to get married because he saw with Ruach HaKodesh that his son would be a Rasha. And because of this, he got sick and he was going to die, and Yeshayahu offered to give his daughter to Chizkiyahu. And of course, Chizkiyahu was right. He had a son, Menashe, big Russia. To top it off, according to Chazal, Menashe killed his grandfather. Menashe killed the Navi Yeshayahu, as it were. So what's the pshat? You see with Ruach HaKodesh, you're going to have a bad kid? I mean, when that kid is born into the world, he's born to be a bad kid? How could that be? People say, bad seed, cursed. We don't believe in that. We believe in Bechira. So you have to understand that nobody is born to be a bad kid. People are born with struggles. And the struggles can lead a person in a certain direction, but HaKadosh Baruch Hu gives you the koach to be miskaber over those struggles. So when we say somebody is born bad, we just mean he's born with an unusually difficult struggle. But the interesting point is, those who are born with an unusually difficult struggle are also given unusually difficult powers to surmount that struggle. And that's how we have to understand Esav. Hashem gave Esav the power to override his very, very strong desires for something bad. Yeah.
Is it, Mutter, if you were, for example, on holiday in Greece to visit temples that are no longer used for the Zohar?
Yeah, this is a very interesting halacha. You know, the Parthenon, right, the Acropolis, all of those monuments, which were idolatrous temples. There is a principle in the laws of Avodah Zarah called bitul, which essentially means mutilation and renunciation. If I, now only a guy can do this, a Jew cannot do this. In other words, if God forbid a Jew worshipped idols, and then a Jew mutilates the idol, he's still not allowed, none of us are allowed to get benefit from it. But the Avodah Zarah of a non-Jew, that the non-Jew has mutilated and renounced, actually becomes Mutter Bahana. So as a result, it would appear that a lot of the ancient Greek temples that are in ruins would qualify as betel, mutilated idolatries, and you would be allowed to go in. As opposed, let's say, to any Jewish, if you found some ancient boma that was used by Jews for idolatry, that would still be prohibited. This is actually a halacha, a Avodah Zarah that belongs to a goy, can be mutter bahana, it's mutter in getting benefit. Also, let me mention another point. The whole issue of even going into a church, is only because of Marisayan. People think you might be worshiping. nobody's going to think, you know, you want to bring a sacrifice to Jupiter or I don't know, to Zeus or whatever it is. So the Maris Ayin in the Greek idolatry doesn't apply either, because these are not religions that anybody practices today, as opposed to Christianity, where, you know, there might be a Maris Ayin and the like. So for those two reasons, I would think it'd be permitted. Yeah.
Are there any halachic issues with litter?
With litter being garbage?
Yeah.
Yeah, there actually is. You know, this is something that we all need to take mussar on. It is forbidden to dump things in a Rishus HaRabim, public areas that don't belong to you. You can litter on your property. That actually is okay. But people don't like to litter on their property. They like to litter on other people's property. So when you throw things away in parks and in the streets, you are creating inconvenience and distress to people in the Rishus HaRabim. So that's a form of Gezel HaRabim. You're stealing from the general public. That's an improper thing to do. The Gemara in Bava Kamma has a very interesting story, although it's not the same as litter, about a man that was trying to clear his garden of stones. So he was taking the stones off his property and throwing them into the street. So one of the Chachamim said to him, why are you taking stones from property that is not yours and putting it on property that is yours? So the person said, I don't know what you mean. It's exactly the opposite. So the Gemara then goes on and says, after a year or so, he lost his property to the government because he didn't pay taxes. And the property belonged to somebody else. And he was homeless. And he's wandering on the streets. And he's tripping on the same stones that he threw a year ago. Which means, indeed, some guy is enjoying this field without any stones in it. And he's tripping on those stones. So that's one thing. It's gezel. Now, I'll tell you, a maisa somebody told me. Again, I don't know if it's true. So I don't want to be makabel lashon hara. But if such a story happens, it's an example of how, you know, outrageously insensitive we can sometimes be to Bein Adam L'Chaveiro. This is involved the park. You know, there are parks, right, all over the place, in Ramat Eshkol, other places. So Shabbos afternoon, there were from families who like to have picnics in the park. They're Somech on the Erev, they have picnics in the park. After they finish the picnic, however, it's still Shabbos, they leave all their garbage in the park. So when somebody who was there said, you know, why don't you clean up after your meal? I said, well, garbage is muksa. We're not allowed to move it on Shabbos. You know, okay, we can talk about the halachas. Is it muksa? Is it not muksa? But the point is, if your garbage is muksa, then you don't have a picnic on Shabbos in a park. However, you make a picnic and then you say, sorry, I can't clean up because it's muksa. You know, this is a pushed an example, and it is unfortunate that. In Eretz Yisrael Bichlal, people are less sensitive to throwing things in the street, and in religious neighborhoods, I think they're less sensitive than they are in even non-religious neighborhoods. But that's a chaval. It's not a good thing. It's not a good thing. And for Kerik, you also see that in Yerushalayim Bedavka, my point is, it's never good to litter. It's a violation of the rights of the B'nai Rishus HaRabim. But in Yerushalayim Bifrat, there's a special avla, because Chazal were very concerned that Yerushalayim should be especially beautiful. They said, for example, you weren't allowed to incinerate, Gemara in Bava Basra, you're not allowed to burn garbage in Yerushalayim because the smoke makes it unpleasant. Now, you might want to tie now, okay, Yerushalayim is the old city, yeah, maybe so, okay, I can't bring a definitive raya there, but L'chala Pachas, the idea of not stealing from the Rishus HaRabim is very, very important.
But in Israel, most people don't seem to mind living in garbage,
so
does Rishus HaRabim still apply?
All right, well, again, the emphasis is even a single person. Rishus HaRabim belongs to everybody, so even a single person is idol. In other words, it's Gezel, even if one person doesn't want. But you do have a point. I mean, there is a point at which something can become mechila, something can become forgiven. But still, it's a violation of Yehaplech Kamocha. Now, the Altar of Slobodka also said that in Eretz Yisrael, picking up garbage is a kiyum of Yishuv Eretz Yisrael, because you're making Eretz Yisrael more habitable. And therefore, according to the Ramban, who says Yishuv Eretz Yisrael is a mitzvah, there would actually be a mitzvah to pick up, not only not to throw, but even to pick up what you have. Yeah.
Why has God this Edom been so much longer than the other
folk? Well, the Medrash tells us, Yeah, the Medrash tells us that Golus Edom is Merumas in the very beginning of the Torah. It says, Ha'aretz ha'isa sayu v'avayu v'chayshech al p'nei tahayim. The land was tayu, astonishingly void, vayu, confused, darkness, al p'nei tahayim, on the depths. So the Medrash says, tayu, it was empty. That's Golus Bavel that destroyed the first Mikdash. Bayu, confused. That's the Golus of Persia. Ha'ir Shushan Nevocha. They were confused with Haman. Chayshach is darkness, because the Greeks tried to take away the light of the Torah by assimilation. Al Panei Tahaim, on the face of the depth. That is Golus Edom, which is like a, it doesn't have an end. It's Tahaim. It goes longer and longer and longer. And longer and longer. So it's Merumas in the Torah that the Golus Edom will be the longest of the Goluses. Why that is so is basically because Golus Edom is designed to eradicate from us Sinas Chinam. Golus Edom came because of the sin of Sinas Chinam, and Sinas Chinam is the hardest Mida to eradicate. And as a result, until we're Masaking the Mida of Sinas Chinam with Abbas Yisrael, we're going to be in Golus Edom. And that's why it's the last and the greatest challenge to be miskaber over the sinas chinam. Yeah. Yeah.
It's the most interesting thing you've ever learned in life.
Oh, gee, you know, I I'm not supposed to say, you know, what's the most interesting thing and the like. But I'll say this. I think that in different stages of everybody's life, you will find things that are more interesting than others. But that will change as you grow in learning. So you could ask me what's the most interesting thing I learned today, and that may not be the same thing as the most interesting thing I learned yesterday. I don't just mean because every day is a new thing, but I mean, but literally, something that really blows your mind at a certain stage of your life might not be so important to you at a later stage. That is the godless of Torah. Torah is the food of the soul. And your soul may need different nourishments at different parts of your life, but there's always something in Torah that's going to give you the food that you need in your neshama, right? So I can ask you the same question, by the way. Here's this. Why should I be the only one who answers the question, right? But the point basically is that you know, we should try to find something good every day in what we learn, something that speaks to us, something that inspires us, something that helps us go on. And it doesn't have to be a big thing. I know myself, sometimes I'll tell you the most fascinating things I have for myself might be something that's so small, I couldn't even tell you why it was so meaningful to me. It's not like a big thing, but you know, maybe I understood where a location was before. Now the Chumash says that something happened in a certain location. And I didn't know where that was, and I found out, you know, oh, Baruch Hashem, I have, you know, now I know where it was. So things like that can sometimes, you know, so every person is different in that way. Yeah.
I was walking through the Mesharim and I saw these from women in like sort of burqa sort of outfits.
Yeah, this is a great country. You know, this is no, because the truth of the matter is, you have to be careful there, because unlike, you know, in the United States, in most places, you know, after 9 o'clock, the streets are empty, deserted, and people don't walk around in the street a lot. Here, there is street theater, there is life, there is always things happening. Now, there's a big Yetzirah, right? A person can spend your whole life here. Looking at the street, reading the signs, and everything else. Obviously, we shouldn't spend our time doing those things. I can tell you this: the women who wear the burqas, you know, it depends. I can't say every woman, but some of the movements. Number one, they were doing so without the consent of their family, husbands. Their husbands were against it, and the rabbanim considered to be, you know, the Eid HaRedis, the Badats of the Eid HaRedis. Issued a pronouncement that it was not proper, that in many, many ways Tznius is about not sticking out. So to be conspicuously sanua is the opposite of tznius. Tznius is not to draw attention to yourself, and if people are staring at you, you're not behaving in a tzniistic manner. So by and large, I would say this is not proper. And it's also not proper because the Torah wants people to be normal. Normal is an important idea here. Normal means that a person avoids immodest situations. A person avoids, you know, social fraternization with men and women together. But it doesn't mean that if there's a woman on a bus, I push her off the seat because she's sitting in the wrong place. It doesn't mean we have to have separate lines in stores. This wasn't true in Europe. This wasn't true in the time of the Vilna Gaon, Rebbe Akiva Eiger. You know, apparently in those days, it was okay for men and women to be in the same store. So in many, many ways, to create things on an obsessional level that is going beyond the Messiah of Am Yisrael is really picking on one part of the Torah and making it so huge that it like overshadows everything else. The whole attitude is wrong. In other words, in effect, if all men or women are thinking about all day is tznius, they are sexually obsessed. They are thinking about sexuality all the time. Right? You're talking about this length, that length, that length, that length. You know, it's like, I'll tell you, a great rav was once Masada Kedushin. And somebody went over to him afterwards and said, how could you recite brachos under the chuppah? Didn't you see the low-cut gown that the mother of the bride was wearing? You're not allowed to say a bracha. So the Masada Kedushin said, I didn't notice. There's a certain wisdom in that. The people who are always noticing how unsanious women are dressed are obviously noticing how women are dressed. Okay? It's a horror. So by and large, I think it's not a good thing. Now, I have an unproven speculation, totally unproven speculation. I have no raya whatsoever, but I have a little bit of a gut reaction that in some ways, women are trying to stick it to their husbands by basically saying, you want tznius? We'll give you tznius. In other words, it's a way of rebelling against the tznius by doing it in such a way that now the husbands feel uncomfortable with it. My editorializing is not important, but the bottom line is that the Eidah Charedus itself, which is the most religious based in the Yerushalayim, did consider this to be improper. And that's a very important point, because once you've created your halachic system and you're trying to sever it, you don't care what Rabbanim say, you don't care what Gedolim say, then you're creating your own religion. And that's a very, very dangerous thing. Right, they're menatek. They rip off from any connection to Gedolei Torah at this point.
Seeing that there's some serious negotiations going on between Israelis and Palestinians now, how should we approach the view or see the negotiations? Something which is negative, positive, promising, destructive?
Well, you know, the Gedolei Torah have the following position. And I know the Rabbi Trevi had a unique position, which actually makes a lot of sense also. The Gedolei Torah take the position that we are permitted to do whatever we can do if it would bring greater peace. So in principle, negotiation and even giving up territory is halachically permitted if it could lead to shalom and the preservation of life. To put it another way, Pikuach Nefesh is more important than holding on to land. Now, the Emma says, Lubavitcher Rebbe actually agreed with that, but he just said, good, yes, Pikuach Nefesh is more important than land. Maskin! But the Rebbe said that giving up land is not going to save lives, it's going to result in more lives. And the Emma says, that's largely been true. That's been borne out by the Metzias. But all I can tell you is, therefore, that the Paiskim do not asser negotiations with the Palestinians if it could bring shalom. But I think mitzidenu, our experience has been that it has not been promising, and therefore it's an asura. I think it should be something that disturbs us simply because it doesn't work and it results in more korbanos, more Jews dying more Jews suffering, and therefore it's not something we could be happy about under any circumstances. The silver lining to this very dark cloud is that, you know, the Torah says over and over again that one of the great nisyanos is we think kochi v'yotzim yadi, it is my strength and my success that has given me hatzlacha in life. Hashem put us in a matzav in Eretz Yisrael where there's nothing we can do to make the situation better. We're powerless. Now, the silver lining in being aware of our powerlessness is that we know it is only HaKadosh Baruch Hu that can help us. And the more we know that, the more we're zeichet to Yeshua. Because the truth of the matter is, the state of Israel is in a hopeless situation. You know, we either have war or we give up territories, in which case there'll be bombings and everything else. So b'derech ha-teva, there is no political way that this situation can be resolved. You know, people like Obama, I'm not going to call Obama anti-Semitic, I don't want to use that lashon, but Obama is at least politically naive. Obama has, you know, a typical, you know, liberal orientation that if we all sit down around the table, and we'll be nice to each other, and we'll be fair to each other, and we'll compromise, this is the Western idea, we'll all be good friends. That's not the Arab mind. It's not the Arab mind. The Arab mind is always, has always been, going back to Mohammed, that any concession is a sign of weakness, and therefore if they see that the Jews are willing to give anything up, we'll keep on going. That's exactly it. That's the Arab mentality. That is the Middle East mentality. So B'derech Klal, there's no way we can be Matzliach here B'derech HaTeva. The Neila, we know, the Yeshua has to come from HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Yeah, one more question.
I was wondering if the Rav could tell us why Chief Rabbi, now former Chief Rabbi, Jonathan Sacks, is considered somewhat controversial in more Haredi circles.
Yeah, yeah. Jonathan Sacks is a wonderful, wonderful person in many, many ways. I think he himself is a Chozer B'tshuva, I believe. I'm not sure. But articulate. He was Margaret Thatcher's favorite clergyman. She liked him much more than the Archbishop of Canterbury. She felt he was more moral and principled than the Archbishop of Canterbury, so she called him her spiritual leader and the like. But on the other hand, you know, Sacks, obviously, one of his missions was to communicate the teachings of Judaism both to the non-Jewish world, so they would understand what the Jewish people are, and to the large percentage of Jews, both in the United Kingdom and throughout the world, who were not connected to Torah, right? So he had to present it, like he couldn't just say, you got to believe this because the Rambam says it. You know, he has to explain it in philosophical terms and the like. So as a result, he was trying, as it were, to explain Judaism and to justify the teachings of Judaism in terms of general philosophical ideas that both non-religious Jews and non-Jews would be able to appreciate. Now, as a result, there were various statements in his book in which he couldn't just say Christianity is false. You know, I mean, that's not going to explain Judaism to a Christian. So he started explaining things. Well, you know, God appears to different people in different ways, and Christianity is how God taught non-Jews, and Judaism is about how God teaches Jews. So he was accused by people of basically saying that Judaism and Christianity are kind of equal in terms of their truth, in terms of their validity. And that was considered to be a very strong kfirah, to say that basically Judaism and Christianity are equally true, but God just gives different messages for different people. So those were the types of things. Now, he backpedaled, he tried to explain it over and over again, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But that was kind of it. The idea basically was that he tried to create common denominators between belief systems that are actually fundamentally contradictory and inconsistent. And in his attempt to reconcile these different religious traditions, he was accused of undermining belief in the absolute truth of Torah, the absolute truth of Judaism. I think that probably was the biggest problem. On the other hand, you know, England is also an interesting place. because the chief rabbi tends to be a bit more on the modern side, but the chief rabbi is not the posek, the main source of halacha in the rabbinate is the London Basin. And the London Basin is a very Haredi basin. So there's this constant conflict between the chief rabbi and the London Basin, and whenever the chief rabbi kind of goes too far to the left, the London Basin will issue a letter denouncing him. So Rabbi Sacks for 25 years was constantly, you know, he was kind of moving to the left here, but he was always being reined back by the London Basin. And which is a good thing, you know, the London Basin kind of makes sure that the chief rabbi doesn't go too far afield.